the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. Well, this morning we speak with University of Utah Professor of Geology and Biology, Tori Serling, about his team's research using elephant teeth to develop methods of tracking the movement of large herbivores.
And then a rebroadcast interview, one of our favorites. We spoke with Ben Stanger. The book we reviewed with him was From One Cell: A Journey into Life's Origins and the Future of Medicine. Fascinating conversation. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Well, Misha the elephant at the Hogle Zoo left behind more than just adoring fans and keepers when she died in 2008. Her teeth that were collected before she was buried are now helping University of Utah geologists develop a method for tracking the movements of large herbivores across landscapes, even for animals now extinct, such as mastodons and mammoths. Here to tell us about Misha's teeth and the isotopes they contain is Tori Serling, a highly decorated, distinguished University of Utah professor of both geology and biology, and a pioneer in the use of isotopic analysis. Professor Tori Serling, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Glad to talk to you.
All right, what is an isotope? Let's just start there because this is the foundation of everything we're going to talk about going forward. So what is an isotope?
Okay, well, all elements on Earth have multiple weights of that particular element. And because they have different weights, they can be separated from each other. And we can use that difference in weights to actually measure them. And so we measure their ratios. And another important thing in the story of Misha is that some isotopes, not very many, but some isotopes are radioactive. And when they are radioactive, they undergo radioactive decay and turn into a different element. And that element is a particular isotope ratio. And in this case, we're using strontium. There are two principal isotopes of strontium, and they've been around ever since the beginning of our planet. But one of them changes over time because of the radioactive decay of a different element, in this case, rubidium. And basically, the difference is that very old geological terrains, like we might find up actually in a number of parts of Utah, have a different amount of one of the isotopes than a very young, say, volcanic terrain. And so it actually is related to the local geology of the region. And that's, with Misha, what we actually use.
Well, how does the local geology of the area get into Misha's molars and tusks? I'm assuming she wasn't gnawing on the dirt and the rocks.
In geology, we say you are what you eat, and the plants grow on the ground, and the plants pick up the ratio of the different isotopes that are reflected of the dirt that they're growing in. And so they actually pick that up. So if you grow hay in one part of the country, it's actually very likely to be have a different isotope ratio than hay from a different part of the country.
Okay, so in the case of Misha, and she was an elephant at Hogle Zoo, and I believe she died in 2008, is that right?
Yes.
And before she was buried, and then I guess it made me think of, wow, burying an elephant, I had never thought about that before. Where was Misha buried, first of all?
I'm not sure, but I think on the zoo grounds.
Okay.
They have a little...
Yeah, animal cemetery. So
you
were able to extract a tusk and her molars, knowing that this sort of study could be undergone. But in the case of Misha, she was always pretty much always in captivity, right? But she was brought from Africa. Can you talk a little bit about Misha and how she was so helpful to aid in this study?
So when she died, I don't remember exactly how old, but she was maybe in her late 20s, and she came from Africa as a very young elephant and was in several different zoos. And for most of her life, she'd actually lived in California. and near Vallejo, California, which is just outside of San Francisco, so in the San Francisco Delta area. So she'd been living there for, I believe, about 20 years or so before she, you know, however they do these transfers, before she was transferred to Salt Lake City. And so when she was in California, they were feeding her California hay grown probably very, very close to the zoo was there. And the geology of California, as you might imagine, is quite different than the geology of Utah. And so she made a very big migration. She moved about, whatever it is, 600 miles in a single day on a truck, and then spent the last three or four years of her life here in Salt Lake City.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Tori Serling. He's a highly decorated University of Utah professor, both of geology and biology, and he's a pioneer in the use of isotope analysis. And he's talking to us about the discovery that they were able to find from Misha the elephant, who was at Hogal Zoo until her death in 2008, and the study from her teeth. So, Tori, how often does this sort of thing happen where you're able to capture, especially, you know, like from a tusk of an elephant, to have this sort of sample size? I suppose it happens a lot, you know, from the paleontological world of dinosaurs.
Yeah, well, sometimes those are a little easier to get than something like this, but there's a lot of interest in trying to reconstruct migration histories. And actually, my colleague Gabe Bowen at the University of Utah is actually working on trying to work with some repatriated remains from some of our servicemen. And they're using isotopes to try to understand where the people may have come from. These would be unidentified. So there's that interest. In archaeology, there's an interest in trying to understand where, you know, what migration routes of people. I mean, I know of examples, for instance, of excavations in the Middle East where related to the Crusaders, were these local people or did they come from somewhere else? And again, what we're using for the new listeners coming on is strontium isotopes, and the strontium isotopes pick up information about the local geology because that's imparted into the food. And so there's many, it's a very big archaeological interest in, you know, were people moving? Were other animals moving? Were people, if they were herding domestic animals, were they moving from one place to another? And how can we sort that out? And then if you're in paleontology with mastodons and mammoths, today the home range of an elephant is thousands of square miles for some of them. And they can move, they'll move, you know, 20 or 30 miles sometimes in a single day, and they'll go camp out somewhere else for a while. There was a project I worked on a few years ago of an elephant who in the dry season, he lived high on a mountain, a volcanic mountain. And then in the rainy season, when everything is lush and green down in the desert, he would actually go down to the desert and I think look for some lady friends. We were able to study this elephant who was moving back and forth up and down the mountain. Every time the rainy season came, he'd be in the desert. Every time a dry season came, he would leave the desert and move about 50 miles in a single day to go live on the mountain for the next whole season. Well, so those are the sorts of possible migration paths. And again, there's a very interesting idea in archaeology and understanding our own personal history.
Tori, do our teeth as humans collect the same isotopes as with elephants? And if so, why was it more interesting to use an elephant's teeth versus, you know, a human for this study?
Well, the answer to your question is yes. And I said earlier on, you are what you eat. So the different tissues in your body record sort of different time frame. So your hair is recording the last year or two, depending on how long your hair is. It's very short, it's not very much. But your teeth are formed starting actually just before you were born, and then you shed those teeth. But those teeth, the enamel in the teeth, is a record of what you were eating when those teeth were forming. And so for adults, it's recording our childhood, basically, because our teeth are fully formed by the time we're 18 or 20 years old. And the different teeth are actually recording different times of your life. So your wisdom tooth, if you're lucky or unlucky enough to have them, is the last formed and probably is recording your early teenage years. Your front teeth are recording where you were living and what you were eating when you were just a few years old, sort of 4 to 5 years old, when those teeth were forming.
So with the elephant's teeth, was this the first time anyone's ever studied this isotope within their teeth? And then when we were talking before we started, you said one of the great things about Misha was you had such a great record of her locations. And so you could test your findings against the locations. But was this the first time this study has been done?
I think it's safe to say it was the first time it was done in this sort of a way. One of the important discoveries that we made was that when you make a move like this, it takes about a year and a half or 2 years to completely come to the equilibration, as it were, with your new habitat. And one of the reasons is that, if you might think, well, where, how in the world do teeth form and what are they recording at the time? Well, they're probably recording your blood serum. That's the part that's circulating around and providing all the chemicals in the different parts of your body to make the different things. On the top of your head, they make hair, and in your fingers, they make fingernails, and in your mouth, they make teeth. With the case of strontium, there's a couple of different ways in which you can get strontium into your body. One is you eat, or into the blood serum, you eat, and that's actually about half of the strontium is in there. But then we also have a stored reservoir of strontium in our body through the bones. Our bones have strontium, and our bones are constantly remodeling. And the thing that we discovered in this study is that this reservoir of strontium in the bones, which is constantly exchanging as you're remodeling your bones and making them stronger and fixing things that need to be fixed, that actually is a big reservoir that takes a long time to completely be overwhelmed by your new environment. And so in this particular case, because we had, you know, a large animal and we had very good time resolution, because in the tusk we just get a little bit of growth every single day, and we could actually sample at a resolution fine enough, we could actually figure out the time. And that's what made this such a wonderful study, is because there's not many animals whose teeth are so large that we could actually sample them and figure out this particular problem.
That's so interesting. So I'm assuming that there's more that can be told about your historical record as a mammal, like, by looking at your teeth rather than bones. Is that correct?
You can learn something about, you know, whatever you're analyzing, you can learn something about the history, but you have to understand the rules. And it's just kind of like when you're taking an English examination, you better remember things about English and not chemistry, and vice versa. And so there are different rules that govern the different tissues. And so the part of this project was learning the rules of how the teeth are formed. That's what made it such a nice study. It's one of the projects some of my students have been working on over the years, is understanding the rules. And then when we look at the record, we know how to read it. And it's actually kind of like a book. You know, if you don't know the rules of the alphabet, then a page can look pretty strange and you're not sure what is there. So we're just trying to learn the rules.
Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, in a very simplistic form, when you see a slice of a cross-section of a tree and you can see the rings, and, you know, just for the average layperson, it tells you about that tree by looking at the rings, and then, you know, that equates with the rules. I'm wondering, you know, we know a lot about human migration over the millennia. And I think about, you know, the Bering Land Bridge, I think it's called, between that used to connect Russia to Alaska, for example. And we know that there was human migration there because of, I think, like genetic studies. But how does the study of the strontium isotope, how does this add on a deeper layer of understanding, or what can it expose to us about human migration and history?
For instance, you might be able to say, well, you could say with an archaeological context, yes, this person, you know, presumably died in this location because he's buried there. But by analyzing the isotopes in the teeth, you might be able to say, well, yes, it's very compatible with this person, was born, lived, and died here. We can see that. But you could also, perhaps another scenario would be, well, wait, this person is definitely not from this locality, at least when they were a child. They would have had to move there when they're older. And if you could analyze the different teeth, you might be able to say, oh, well, this person, you know, moved here when they were such and such an age. So that would be one, and that has been used in archaeology. And then if you have the information that it did not come locally, you could speculate on, well, what are the possible places based on your isotope measurements that are compatible with their origins?
Will they be able to use this sort of analysis in prehistoric fossilized dinosaur remains to get some sort of a better understanding of their environment?
I think so. In certain cases, what you'd need is essentially a large enough tooth that could record a travel history. So you kind of need the right size and the right shape of tooth to be able to do that. And you would have to understand, again, for that particular tooth, what is the growth pattern of a tooth? That turns out an elephant tusk is the easiest of all. It's like a continuous conveyor belt that keeps moving in one direction and has a pretty constant growth rate. And actually you can actually slice it very thin and look at it under a microscope, and you can actually see the individual daily growth lines. They're pretty tiny, but with a strong enough microscope, you can see that. So you can then actually know what the rate of growth is. So if you're going to apply that, you need to, again, understand what the rules are that you need to make your interpretation in that context.
So you are a distinguished professor of both geology and of biology. What is the correlation or confluence between those two? Because I think a lot of us look at geology as just rocks and biology as plants, and we don't necessarily see a meshing of the two, but obviously you do.
Well, I guess I'd say they're both more aligned with, you know, the traditional natural history of our planet. And I will say that for me, when I was an undergraduate, I was starting out in science and engineering, and I discovered that what I really was interested in is using the chemistry and physics of the Earth to understand the natural history. And for me, what I've found in working in fossil deposits, and I've worked quite a lot on early man sites in Africa, is that to really fully interpret the geological past, you need to understand the modern setting. And so I've been deeply involved in both working on modern, sort of the modern equivalent of whatever those fossils are. So I've done a lot of work on fossil elephants. I've done a lot of work on modern elephants, actually in Africa. And so when Misha died, I just thought, oh, this is a possible opportunity. We didn't know at the time that it was going to be as great help as it's been. But the veterinarian at the zoo, who was then Nancy Carpenter, was just incredibly helpful and generous. And it also, you know, is, I think, a little bit of an example of sort of these unexpected things in life that if you cooperate with some people and meet some new people, you can really make some wonderful discoveries.
Yeah, that's for sure. It must delight someone like you, because you have always worked in an interdisciplinary setting, but it seems like more and more the benefits of not working in silos, especially in science, really prove to uncover so much more and help forward science. Can you talk a little bit about that collaboration?
Yeah, it. I mean, there's always so much. There's so much to be known, and there's an awful lot known by other people that you haven't had the benefit of. And at the University of Utah, I remember some years ago, I was very fortunate to make the acquaintance of Jim Elringer in the biology department, and I've been collaborating with him now for 35 years. My original appointment was only in geology. And through these collaborations at the university, I sort of learned more and more biology and began to be involved in and realized that my perspective of the geosciences actually had valuable perspectives of the biological sciences, in part because I was also interested in modern processes. And the modern processes that turn rocks into geology are the modern processes that where biology is extremely active. And so, for me, the University of Utah and the collaborations that I found in the biology department, starting with Jim Elringer, but then with other people in the department, has just made for a very good intellectual collaborative experience.
That's interesting. I know that a lot of your work also uncovers for you the various climates throughout the ages, and you're involved a lot in looking at climate change. Can you relate what the work, this the specific work, if there is anything that you did with Misha that kind of uncovers more about our changing climate?
Well, with Misha, one of the other, we worked on other isotopes as well, including carbon and oxygen isotopes, which tell you about different other aspects of the diet, in particular the kinds of food they were eating, not where it was grown, like the strontium isotopes. And the oxygen isotopes tell us about the water. And in East Africa, working with the early human people and the evolution of man, we've been trying to develop methods to understand what the ancient climates were like and what the ancient environments were like. That's one aspect.
So, in reading the article that came out about your research, it's not just about ecological changes, climate changes. This work can also help protect these elephants against ivory hunters. How does that work?
We're working with a group at University of Washington who have been interested in the elephant ivory problem. And there are, there's these large seizures made by customs officials in different countries. And these will be large, like 6 tons of ivory. And that really represents, hundreds, sometimes hundreds of elephants. So we're working with them to try to figure out when the animals died and where possibly they came from. And we do this in a combination of ways. There's an isotope of, you may have heard of carbon-14 dating, which is used in archaeology, but there's a special form of carbon-14 dating that relies on the fact that during in the Cold War, with the above-ground testing of nuclear weapons, we changed significantly the concentration of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. And we can use that to figure out when animals died. And we were able to show that all of the ivory that is confiscated by these customs officials came from animals that died very recently. It's not old ivory that's been lying around, which people wanted to believe. That's not true. And then with the genetics, my colleague at University of Washington, Sam Wasser, can say, well, these animals came from this part of Africa. And if you look at a map, it looks like they've pinpointed it. But if you're on the ground, it doesn't. It comes from an area maybe the size of Utah. And so then again, with the strontium isotopes, we say, well, what is the geology like where they came from? And then we can often pinpoint where the animals come. So it comes this combination of the genetics and the geology, and we're using that to find out where illegal wildlife hotspots are a problem.
It's important work. Our guest today has been Professor Tory Serling. He is a distinguished professor of both geology and biology at the University of Utah, and a part of a team that has been studying strontium isotopes in the teeth from Misha the elephant. Tari, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Okay, well, thank you.
Loved speaking with that wonderful professor. So much going on at the University of Utah that I think a lot of times, even though it's right down the road, we don't know about, but so much interesting research and yeah, he was a great guy.
Yeah.
Professor Emeritus, very distinguished.
And geology and biology.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. Okay. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. We'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
How does a human develop from a single cell into a complex and unique individual? How do these cells communicate? And how have scientists and philosophers gone about discovering, understanding, and even grasping this complex yet essential element of life's origins? Joining us to answer these and many other questions is Ben Stanger, author of From One Cell, A Journey into Life's Origins and the Future of Medicine. Ben, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Great to be here.
You know, I certainly take cells for granted. We're used to just walking around with skin and organs and hair and forgetting that that is what makes up life. One thing I was thinking about as I was reading your book, you know, the cell and its unique ability to duplicate, to change, is that foundation of life. Yet other things, such as matter or energy, they don't. So how is it that the cell, the simple cell made of these same simple elements as matter and energy, developed this ability to grow and evolve and basically like create life around us?
That is a great question. It's almost a philosophical question. Why isn't mud alive and why are we? You know, the short answer, of course, is evolution. It's chemistry that started out in very primitive forms that was able to create molecules that were capable of making other molecules that resembled them in some way. And from there, you built a membrane around those molecules, and the molecules, eventually nucleic acids, encoded information that could then allow that cell and its progeny to develop in different ways. So those early stages of life and how one went from organic matter to life was actually what interested me in biology in the first place in high school. And it's still a question that I really wish I knew the answer to, but it's a toughie. Happened a long time ago.
Well, Ben, you know, I'm wondering, as we look at, and as Katie says, we sort of take it for granted that a cell duplicates and a cell does its thing. You know, you talk about the one big problem, or the problem with the one cell problem. And I'm wondering, over the years, what the theories have been, how they've been proven or disproven, and what does that mean for where we are now, what researchers are doing, what you are doing right now to sort of figure out what goes on with a cell?
Yeah, you know, so the title of the book is From One Cell, and I spend a lot of time talking about the one cell problem. And what that is, in brief, is that just this unbelievable, surprising, miraculous fact that all of the trillions of cells in our body all came from one single, simple cell that's about the diameter of a hair. It's just incredible when you think about that. Two things had to happen for a body to form from one cell. One is that you have to make many, many, many cells, and that's one cell going to two, to four, to eight, et cetera. But maybe even more importantly, you have to diversify. Those cells have to take on different identities to become the different organs of our body, the kidney, the eye, the heart, and so on and so forth. Nature had to figure out a way to solve both of those components of this one cell problem. The first part was solved billions of years ago with single cell organisms. So it wasn't a simple problem, but nature figured out how to make cells divide. But it wasn't until around 600 million years or so ago that nature figured out how to take those dividing cells and get them to diversify in some way, to have the daughter cells of a single cell or the cells in the embryo to take on these different identities so that you have a multicellular organism. And all of that biology, all of the things that lead to the creation of of an animal with many, many different types of cells is proving to be incredibly important for medicine and the things we're trying to do to regenerate organs.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Ben Stanger. He is a professor of medicine and cell and developmental biology at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a practicing gastroenterologist with Penn Medicine. And we're talking to him about his new book, From One Cell, A Journey into Life's Origins and the Future of Medicine. And Ben, this may be a bit of a tangent, but I can't help myself seeing that you're a practicing gastroenterologist and knowing what we know, and maybe it's even in popular media, saying that our gut is our second brain. And what has been researched and sort of the conclusions that scientists have gotten to about the importance of gut health, your microbiome. Could you comment on that?
Absolutely. It's actually not really a tangent, because anything in adult biology, anything that affects our bodies, all is a result of development and all of the things that have to go right and have to come together. Just to kind of take a step back from your question, our gut, what you could call the second brain, is of course a mixture of many different types of cells. The important features of the gut are to be able to digest food and to be able to take those nutrients up into the body, but that isn't simply done by a simple lining of cells that absorb nutrients. There are all different layers within the gut. There's muscles that propel things along, and there are immune cells to make sure that the things that we shouldn't be ingesting don't get into our body and infect us. And there are nerves. There are plenty of nerves to make sure that the gut is moving properly. And of course, inside the lumen, the center of the gut, there are lots of bugs. And those bugs are really important for proper digestion, but they also can cause us harm if they get out of control or that balance is thrown off. There's a lot going on. All of that sort of gets set in motion through development. And the more that we learn about how those different parts of the gut or any organ for that matter come together in development, the more we can understand how they're going wrong in disease and what we can do about it.
Ben, I loved how you were talking about how our cells, they form a collective and they talk and they work together and they communicate. In all of your research on cells for this book, was there something that fascinated you or surprised you the most?
Well, I mean, I've been working in the field for a long time. I've been a developmental biologist. I'm mostly a cancer biologist now. I think the thing that struck me in putting this all together to think about it for this book is how much we really still don't know or understand. It's just an amazing thing that we can be here from instructions that are present in the nucleus of a single cell. And as that cell does those early divisions, that there's enough instructions there that the cells can somehow figure out what they're supposed to be. And as you say, they do that by communicating with other cells. How does that happen? We have the really most superficial idea of what that kind of communication is like and how it operates in a way to form another organ. To put it another way, you know, we would love to be able to make new organs for transplantation for someone, a patient who's in kidney failure or liver failure or has a heart attack. We really don't have a clue. We're not even close to knowing how to rebuild a new organ. And yet, billions of times a day on our planet, new organs are all coming together naturally through this process that evolution has devised for us.
Well, and you think about as these cells, they all start out with the same DNA sequences. And then as they grow, they develop into their specific roles. But once they're grown, they have this innate knowledge for how to behave and what their function is. Do we have any idea where that innate, who teaches them this?
That is a wonderful question. And it was actually something that scientists struggled with early on. As scientists in the early 20th centuries were starting to think about genes, and they had an understanding that genes must regulate what cells do and what they become. So how would this work? How does a gene control inheritance between generations in evolution? in passing along from one generation to the next, the instructions for a species, and how do genes instruct a cell what to become as those cells are dividing during development and differentiation, which is the specialization into the different kinds of cells. A simple idea that came along early, and it's a really elegant idea, is that as cells divide, they start out with all the instructions, all the possible things that they could become. And then little by little, as they specialize, they lose some of those instructions. So you could become anything. You have the, you know, the encyclopedia that tells you every possibility. But then as you make the decisions, let's say, or you go down the path of becoming a kidney cell, you lose all the instructions to become a neuron or to become a heart cell. You lose those genes. That's a very clever way that you might imagine nature could have done it, but that's not the way it works. The way it works is every cell has a complete set of genes. That's called genomic equivalence. And it's that fact that makes cloning a possibility. You can clone a new animal from an individual cell because every cell in the body has the complete set of instructions. So instead of losing genes, the way that it works is that certain genes are silenced and certain genes are given an amplifier as development proceeds. So those genes that are important for a kidney, those genes get turned on and they're given voice. And those genes that are not needed for kidney development get silenced and they sit there, but they don't really do very much.
When you were talking, it reminded me of, you know, like a teenager when they seemed to go off the rails. Like they started off with all the best instructions and all the best, you know, parenting. And then somewhere in there, something goes awry and can become troublesome teenagers. But I wanted to ask you about, a few minutes ago, you talked about regenerative medicine, and this is sort of a buzzword out there right now. And you see clinics opening, offering regenerative medicine and some really newfangled kind of crazy technology that is supposed to sort of realign what's going on in your body. And I suppose even on a cellular level, I'm not too sure, but could you take us through what regenerative medicine is as you write about in your book?
The big idea behind regenerative medicine is to take tissues, cells that are lost to disease, that die, that no longer function through wear and tear, and to replace them with tissues that have somehow been engineered in the laboratory. That's the big picture. And it's an incredibly powerful idea because as we age, organ failure of one sort or another is inevitable. And if we could just pull off the shelf a new kidney, a new liver, a new lung, we would bypass the need for transplantation from another individual, especially if that new tissue could come from your own cells. There wouldn't be the problems with immune rejection and so on and so forth. That's the promise of regenerative medicine. And one of the big vehicles for that has been stem cells, the hope that stem cells, because stem cells have the potential to turn into any cell in the body, that stem cells might be the fuel for regenerative medicine. I do want to caution that there are a lot of clinics, as you say, offering regenerative medicine therapies. I think people need to be really, really cautious about that. Of course, I'm trained in the Western medicine tradition, but I really think it's important to be skeptical and to only embark on therapies, especially new therapies, for which there's strong, robust evidence. So that being said, there are actually very few regenerative medicine therapies currently in existence that have met that bar, that do actually have good rigorous evidence behind them. And there are others that are coming along. One that I talk about in the book a bit is the use of stem cells to create new beta cells of the pancreas. The beta cells of the pancreas are the cells that make insulin, and they're lost in diabetes, in type 1 diabetes in particular. And new therapies are figuring out ways of making those beta cells from stem cells, giving them to patients. And in the early studies, patients are being cured of their diabetes with this therapy.
Wow, that's really exciting. In terms of research with stem cells, it's important, I think, for listeners and for all of us to understand what the history was and why research with stem cells was kind of thwarted in the early 2000s, and what you're doing now that is different than what was done before?
So stem cells come from that early part of the embryo. So maybe when the embryo has 100 cells or so. So it's really a clump of cells. It's not what you might think of an embryo that looks like a mini baby. It's a clump of cells. Still, to get those cells from a human embryo requires the destruction of that human embryo. And so when scientists figured out how to make embryonic stem cells from human embryos in the late 90s, there was a bit of an outcry over allowing this research to proceed, especially using federal research dollars. And George Bush instituted a policy in 2001 that federal dollars could be used for stem cell research in a very, very limited fashion, in a way that really stunted the field. The result of that was that there was a lot of private money that came in to fund stem cell research. So the research certainly continued quite a bit. But really what changed the landscape was a remarkable discovery in the early 2000s by a Japanese scientist. And what he found was that it's possible to take any cell in the body, virtually any cell, a skin cell, a cell from the inside of the cheek, whatever you want, a blood cell, and through a form of genetic engineering, get that cell to behave like an embryonic stem cell, get that cell to basically be possible under the right circumstances of turning into any cell in the body. But what's quite different about that, which is called induced pluripotency, is the technical term for that. What's different, of course, is that you're not using an embryo to get your embryonic stem cells. You're using any mature cell from an individual in the body. So much, if not most, of the stem cell research that's happening today is employing these induced pluripotent cells that come from an individual instead of the embryonic stem cells that come from an embryo.
We talk about some things that are controversial, like stem cells, but also cloning, you know, the Dolly the sheep. It comes with its own caveats and worries. But in the book, you talk so much about how cloning of frogs was essential to this original research. Tell me more about that.
That cloning of frogs, the phenomenon of cloning, was scientifically the way that we learned that all cells in the body have the same set of genes. Early efforts at cloning failed, and that was deemed to be evidence that cells lost genes. But eventually, a scientist, John Gurdon in England, showed that no, you can take a cell from the intestine, as you were mentioning before. You know, it's from the intestine, it's very specialized, it looks nothing like an embryonic cell. But then, if you take the nucleus from that cell and put it into an egg, you can get a whole new frog to come out of that. So that meant that that cell had all the genes necessary for development. That then allowed us to understand at a fundamental level, how does differentiation occur? The paradox is if every cell in the body has the same set of genes, then why are there different kinds of cells? If everybody has the same instructions, why are some different than others? And that led us to that process of gene regulation, some genes being on, some genes being off, that we talked about earlier, that kind of educational process.
So in that cell development, what role does bacteria and viruses play? We assume cell development is strictly an internal DNA component.
Yeah, it largely is, with some exceptions. So in general, we think of development happening in a protected environment. So microbes are not really participating. It's as sterile as we could possibly hope for. The one exception, though, is the viruses that have infected our ancestors over millions of years and integrated their DNA into our genomes. I'm not sure if your listeners are aware of this or not, but large quantities of our genomes are actually the remnants of viruses that infected us over millions and millions of years. Millions of nucleotides of the GATC in our genomes come from those viruses. Those viruses aren't actively making viral particles, so they're not infectious anymore, but they sit there in the genome, and they actually have a role in telling our genes, the genes that are involved in our development, whether to be on or off. So we've sort of, over time, developed this symbiotic relationship between these viral ancestors and our own genes to make everything work out the way it does.
I have to tell you this fascinating story I was listening to yesterday on a podcast about cloning. And it was this family somewhere that had a family farm. They had this particular bull that was their pet. He was very docile. He was very friendly. They loved this bull. They cloned him and he died. And they produced another bull that was exactly the same. This bull went to the same corner of the pen to lay down. It acted in many ways just like the first bull. However, the second bull, something went awry and he gored his owner three times. And, you know, and the question became like, it wasn't really about nurture because they were nurturing the same bull in the same way and it was the same family. And so it just makes me wonder about how development is interrupted and can be interrupted. And I was thinking about, like, in the case of COVID, and you're talking about virus, how are we evolving and changing with certain things interrupted? And I wonder what interrupted the development of that cloned bull.
Everything in our lives is a dance between nature and nurture. It's an age-old debate, and of course, both are critical. Even identical twins who have exactly the same DNA are going to have gone through a different developmental journey and have differences. But yet, as we all know, there are uncanny similarities, not just physical, between identical twins. It's a great question, but I think it's a hard question to get at. Development is incredibly resilient. So when things go wrong, cells find themselves in the wrong place, a bunch of cells die during development, most of the time, the system is so robust that other cells take over and make everything right. But of course, there may be consequences that are only seen later in life in behavioral or other manifestations that we can't understand at this point.
You probably cringe when I brought that story up because I don't even know where it came from. I feel like now I have to really look it up and see if it's real or what happened. But I heard it on a pretty credible podcast.
Sounds pretty cool.
Just a final question. How is this research allowing us to be more predictive of things like cancer? And then how can we, through precision medicine, sort of target those cancers before they become fully developed?
A chapter in the book is devoted to cancer and the links between cancer and embryonic development. You think on face value, they're very different. An embryo is this very organized organism that's going to give rise to an animal. Cancer is a disorganized set of cells that are growing out of control. But the basic biology is actually the same. Cancer doesn't really invent new rules. It just uses the principles, the molecules, the techniques that were relevant during the rapid growth of an embryo and then puts them to new creative uses. I would say that the more we've learned about development, the more that's helped us understand cancer. The kinds of signals that cells give to each other during development are the same signals that cancer cells use to, for instance, recruit blood vessels to get the things from normal cells that they need to be able to grow. And many of our emerging cancer therapies are coming from an understanding of those molecules that are relevant during development.
Well, Ben, I have to admit that biology hadn't been one of my favorite science topics. I'm more of an earth science gal. But after reading this book, it shed this whole new light on the importance and the complexity of this life-giving topic. What do you hope the average reader is going to get out of your book?
A couple of things. One is, of course, I want them to be excited by biology and science as you were. So that would be the first thing. The other is to come away with an better understanding of what science is. I think we're often acclimated to science being this set of facts or techniques, or this is, you do science, now science has shown this. Really, science is more about the questions, much about the questions as it is about the answers. It's a process of discovery, and it's incredibly exciting to start with a phenomenon, to start with the kinds of questions that we've been discussing here what we really don't know the answer to, but to be able to say, how could we answer this question? How can we learn more about what goes into these behavioral features? What happens? What are the consequences of something going wrong during development? That's why I love being a scientist, is because it's really just a life of puzzle solving. And I hope the book captures some of that spirit of the scientists who approach problems in that way.
The book is From One Cell, A Journey into Life's Origin and the Future of Medicine. Well, Ben Stanger, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio and really, you know, telling us and our listeners about this fascinating world that we're learning more and more of each day.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Just a few reminders here coming up with Earth Day celebration on April 22nd. This is Recycle Utah, and this is a great way to support a local nonprofit that does some really great work in the community. That would be 5 to 8 p.m. on April 22nd, Tuesday. It's all taking place at Twisted Fern Restaurant. That's in Snow Creek. And a great opportunity drawing. Whatever it's called these days here in Utah. But some really wonderful businesses have stepped up to help out Recycle Utah, who diverts so much from going into the landfill. And we know that landfill is almost full.
And also on that same night is Jill Heinhurst. She was our guest a few weeks ago. She's the amazing cave diver who's the first person to have ever dove into a cave in an iceberg. And she's speaking at Kingsbury Hall as part of Earth Day celebrations through the Utah Museum of Natural History. And she's going to be a fascinating speaker.
Lots to do on Earth Day. Thanks for tuning in.